Welcome to the Flow Tracy Money Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording. It is 1:06 PM, the Pacific Summer Time. Today is July 17th, and today being Friday, it's the big picture, long-term audio and video for the various different asset classes. I thought we'd kick off today with this graphic, because I thought it was quite interesting that in the returns on the S&P 500 over the course of the last 5 years, if you were not in the communication services, consumer discretionary, which is basically a euphemism for Amazon, and then the technology sector, you missed out on 78% of the gains. And overall, energy was negative, materials were pretty much a write-off, so were financials, and so were consumer staples. So we've been through a prolonged period where classic cyclicals have underperformed. Now, historically, technology would also have been lumped in with those cyclicals, whereas the main point here is that investors are increasingly starting to look at historic cyclicals and thinking that they may outperform in the next 5 years simply because we've had such a stellar performance of the technology sector and anything attached to it. Over the course of the last 5 years. But of course, that ignores the fact that technology itself does tend to be highly cyclical. One of the reasons why it is less cyclical today than it used to be is because of the evolution of the subscription business model. And Microsoft is a perfect example of that. When back in the 1990s, they used to bring out a version of their software. Then they would go off and try and sell it. They'd have to deal with bugs. They would have to go ahead and bear the cost of developing the next iteration of the software. And then they would have to try and go out and sell that. And then the entire process would start off again while they were still bearing the cost of sustaining and maintaining the previous versions of their software. And that created a high cyclicality in terms of the lumpiness of cash flow origination into the balance sheet. When you adopt a subscription business model, well, then you smooth out that lumpiness. Then instead of having to rely on incremental chunks of new cash coming in, you're getting steady flows. And it has been the creation and dispersion of the subscription business model right across the entire new technology sector that has contributed to the smoothness with which they've been able to rally. And it has also afforded analysts greater leeway to attach higher valuations for the simple reason that the cash flows have less risk attached to them and there's more transparency. Well, Microsoft has exploded higher over the course of the last decade, and most particularly since it adopted the subscription business model back in 2014. Well, we have got a significant downward dynamic in here this week. It's not a key reversal, but certainly the price has pulled back in a sharper manner and closed closer to the low than it has at any point since the lows in March. And well, that at least begins to suggest that we have a peak of near-term significance. However, when we do look at it on a daily basis, then we can see that the size of the reactions to date have been relatively similar sized, and this one is not an exception. It is coming back down towards the psychological $200 level, and this area should represent support if we are in fact going to continue to see the market trending higher from here. One of the most commonly quoted rationales for thinking that cyclicals will outperform technology is because of the elevated level of the NASDAQ Russell 2000 ratio. It's now up to about 7.25, and that is approximating the peak that we saw for the ratio all the way back in 2000. And we have seen that certainly relative to the pace and consistency of the relative advance since 2017, we have certainly had an acceleration and much more choppy action. So it's not beyond the bounds of possibility at all that we may see that the smaller cap sector or the wider market will potentially now start to do better than the mega cap technology companies. Now, we saw, for example, that the CEO of BlackRock, Larry Fink, was talking today about the polarity that you have in the recovery of the US economy, that small businesses are really struggling, whereas the larger businesses have had better access to capital and have been doing better. Well, unfortunately for some of those smaller investors, they're not listed on the stock market. It's companies have generally been better able to attract interest, or at least to attract the attention of loan officers, and been able to capture a lot of the funds that have been made available. And we can't really argue with the chart pattern. There's a clear acceleration that is a trend ending. We've had more volatility. Now the big question is whether this relative uptrend is going to remain consistent. It's already inconsistent because of the acceleration, loss of momentum. Now, will it be able to hold the region of the upper side of the underlying range? So what happens in the course of the next few weeks is certainly going to be really quite instrumental in giving us an indication of whether we are in fact going to get a significant rotation, not simply a rotation on the basis of a week or two or a month or two, but whether we are in fact getting progressively closer to a relative peak in the technology sector. When we think about cyclicals generally, well, I think we can simply look at the three main ones, which would be the oil market, the industrial resources miners, and then the banks. So perhaps we should start with the banks, because they have been vilified in the press and in public opinion for most of the last decade. But the banking sector is integral to the global economy. They are liquidity providers. And in order to have a bull market, you'd need to have a reasonably healthy banking sector. Well, the S&P 500 banks index has steadied over the course of the last few months, but it has not been able to sustain a move above the trend mean, and it is hard to imagine how they are going to be able to make money when they don't have a spread between the short and the long end of the curve, because the primary business model of banks is to borrow long-term, lend short-term, pick up the spread between the two, and then you get a nice risk-free way of making money. Unfortunately, because of the way that the Federal Reserve is structuring their assistance, they are controlling the yield curve. Now, that has not yet been announced as an overt policy, but when we look at the spread, we can see that it has gone nowhere since March, and that is quite contrary to what we've seen on other occasions, because generally speaking, after an inversion, the normal course of events is for a wide differential between the long and the short end of the curve, and for a spread of 250 basis points, which effectively recapitalizes the banking sector and allows them the wherewithal to start lending money again. Well, we are just not seeing that, at least so far, in this spread. And it represents an existential threat for the banking sector, not just for the big banks, but also for the small banks. When you've got interest rates that are nominally zero, and then subsequently do not have an interest rate spread from which to make money, then banks are really in trouble. Excuse me. So when we then think about how is that translating internationally, well, European banks are at least steadying because they have got the Not necessarily that they have got better prospects of making money on an interest rate spread, not least because they are contending not with nominally zero interest rates but negative interest rates, but rather that the ECB and European governments apparently are getting progressively closer to taking off the fiscal straitjacket, and that there will be more money made available for productive uses. So that is potentially better for the banks. When we look at the UK's banks, well, they remain moribund and right in the region of the lows from back in March. Now, of course, the primary reason for that is because of HSBC, and that has obviously got some challenges, not least because they've got such a large Chinese franchise, so the share is still right on its lows. But then also, when we look at domestic UK banks, Lloyds is also right on its lows. So UK banks are contending with a slow economic recovery, and then also the uncertainty of Brexit. The big questions that remain outstanding about what exactly they need to do in order to create a profitable environment going forward, these have not yet been answered. So banks are still struggling in the UK. Banks in Japan have got more experience than anywhere else of contending with a zero interest rate environment and an inability to charge a margin on loans, and it has steadied from the region of the lows from all the way back in 2012. Now, we would need to see a really quite sustained rebound here in order to sustain a move above the trend mean to break the more than 2-year downtrend, confirm more than near-term support in the region of that 100 level. But I think it is worth highlighting that Japanese banks have been ranging above 100 now for most of the last 17 years. It has been an area of support on multiple occasions, and they have at least had decades with which to deal with these extremely low interest rate environments. So the big question is what's going to happen now in terms of the Japanese market overall, because the Bank of Japan owns a progressively larger proportion of all shares outstanding. They have a very substantial position in ETFs, and those as money gets poured into those ETFs, then they buy up companies. At some stage, it will be are the it is not at all beyond the bounds of possibility that central banks who buy equities could start voting at shareholder meetings. And one of the biggest considerations when you buy an ETF, it affords an investor or a very large investor the opportunity to build a position in equities without having to trigger takeover rules. If you were an individual investor buying up significant proportions of individual companies, then you would be in a position to either take over the company or be forced to make an offer to take over the company. If you're doing so through ETFs, then you avoid that pressure. But when a central bank buys all of the available units in ETFs tracking significant indices within a country, and then subsequently nationalizes the ETF industry, well, then it owns very substantial proportions of the entire private sector. And it is a nationalization that is stealth in nature. Now, that's particularly relevant for Japan. They've been dealing with this deflationary environment for a prolonged period. There is a clear need to develop positions in productive assets. I think I've seen a number, in fact, I've seen a number of articles talking about the fact that the Bank of Japan's purchase program for Japanese equities has been unsuccessful because the prices have been volatile and they may even have taken a loss on their positions. But that's missing the point. Because what we are very much in the world today is a period of extraordinary monetary and fiscal, not simply stimulus, but policy. And there are a whole range of new and untested programs that have been put in place in different countries around the world. Japan's experimentation with buying equities through ETFs is one such example, and in extremis, it will result in nationalization. Switzerland has gone the other way. They have been buying up big US technology companies, not necessarily with an aim of taking over those companies, but rather to take positions in productive assets. Because the reality is that when we have got a very wide interest rate differential, which is something that was almost unheard of previously, then it makes sense to buy equities over bonds. When you get a 125 basis point pickup on equities over bonds, then it makes sense for any investor to buy those equities. But it makes particular sense for central banks and governments, not least because the utility of owning one's own paper is less, I think, or it is not as productive an asset as taking a piece of the private economy and ensuring that you get a nice return in terms of a dividend from it indefinitely. And of course, the big difference is that dividends increase over time, and that is not necessarily the case with government bonds. But what it also helps is to create is an additional outlet, because most governments in the Western world or in developed nations are now broke. They have got massive pension liabilities. It's going to be a yoke around their necks for the foreseeable future, and they need to come up with an idea about how to deal with it. And so far, this policy of buying equities is at least potentially setting the stage for that kind of phenomenon. I did find this additional graphic in here this week, where it gives us the number of S&P 500 companies paying dividends greater than the 10-year yield. Now, we can see that it got up to about 50% after the GFC and the EU debt crisis, then the China and the oil shock in 2015 and 16, and now with the pandemic, we are up to approximately 80% of companies that are yielding more than the 10-year treasury rate. But it is particularly relevant to point out that this is an odd situation, and that the number of companies that could make that boast was really quite low until approximately 2007. Now, that is a factor of just how low interest rates have gone, so that the hurdle for beating the return on treasuries in terms of yield is much lower than it used to be. But the last time we saw anything like this was in the 1930s. So what that also helps to highlight is that there are times when there is a loss of faith in the ability of the government to command or to attract investors, that and that there is the potential that we're going to get lower interest rates, that or there is less confidence in the entire system, so we get lower interest rates, and that equities can yield more than bonds. Of course, it also points towards a deflationary environment. Now, there is, of course, the potential that we're going to see this spread contract meaningfully. We've seen that after each of the other significant crises in the course of the last 12 years. And if that's the case, then it is either going to result in a significant pop on the upside in yields, or we are going to see that equity prices go up substantially. Well, let's think about the 10-year treasury, which is pretty much inert. We're still around the 62 basis point level. That is exactly where we were approximately 3 months ago. As long as the yield is going sideways, it is unwinding that overextension relative to the 200-day moving average, and it would need to at least sustain a move above that level in order to really question the demand-dominated environment. I continue to think that the 30-year yield is the most important because it, as a long-dated instrument, it is very sensitive to interest rates, and it has also got a clear level around the 2% area, which would be a very clear indication of where we might anticipate that a real inflationary problem might take hold. Well, that I think is one of the more important considerations, because 2% on the 30-year has been an area around which yields paused for at least the last 8 years. If we see yields pushing back above 2%, it is going to be pretty clear that we are back in an inflationary environment. And I do think it is likely that with the kind of strength that we're seeing in gold, where the price has pushed from $1,400 a year ago to $1,800 now, and that it has been really quite admirably holding on to that $1,800 area, that is really quite positive. One thing that is, I think, also particularly noteworthy is the consistency of the trend. We obviously did have a really quite abrupt pullback in March, and outside of looking at other markets, these kinds of abrupt pullbacks in gold in a bull market are almost universally going to be buying opportunities, and they do occur. That is one of the issues with paying up for commodities, because they're historically volatile, that they are capable of failed upside breaks and pulling back in a sharp manner, and yet still being in a bull market. But one thing, again, that is particularly, I think, interesting is just how inert gold prices have been. They've been churning out successive new highs on a reasonably regular basis, and this range with an amplitude of less than $20 over the course of the last 2 weeks is another example of this general path towards higher prices, but that we are not getting the kind of volatility recently for which gold is really historically known. But I do, when I look back at least my personal experience with gold, I was really quite weary, or not weary, but wary of gold back in 2011 and 12. There were buy your gold stores on practically every corner. There was a really sense that people were getting over-enthusiastic, and the price really pulled back very meaningfully into the low in 2015. And then we saw this massive reaction against the prevailing downtrend and a period of right-hand extension, so that the entire base formation created this rounding characteristic between approximately 2013 and all the way through to 2019. We've subsequently seen the breakout. We saw a reasonable consolidation, and then new low. The sequence of higher reaction lows has been held, and it has continued higher from here. And the price is now north of $1,800, and that was an important area of resistance all the way back in 2011 and 12. And it does hold out the prospect that we are going to see the price of gold pushing on to new high ground in US dollar terms, probably before the summer is over. Now, when we think about gold relative to all of the, or I guess the other ways of playing gold, then perhaps the most important of those is the gold-silver ratio. I found it particularly interesting because it gives us a clear evidence that in the early parts of bull markets in gold, silver underperforms, and that is when this ratio rises. So, for example, if we go all the way back to 2000, gold prices had bottomed, silver had been underperforming gold for at least 5 years through to 2003, and then went into a significant period of outperformance. And that lasted pretty much all the way through until 2006. We had then another significant period of underperformance by silver during the global financial crisis. By the time we saw some steadiness coming through in early 2009, silver started to outperform again, and it doubled relative to gold. It went from 80 to under 40, and then subsequently gave up the entire advance and then more. And this 120 area is an historic low for silver versus gold. Well, now we're seeing that silver has recouped much of the decline, and it is right in the region of the trend mean. In fact, it is below the trend mean as of today. Now the question is whether it can sustain this move. I think it is quite likely that silver will be completing its base formation in the not too distant future. It's up now to $19.74, and if it can sustain a move above 20, we're back in a medium-term demand-dominated environment, and it will have completed its base formation, but it will perhaps then also break its sequence of higher re or of it will break gold's sequence of higher reaction lows against it on a relative basis, so that we'll have clear evidence of silver returning to medium-term demand dominance. And that is emblematic of the second psychological perception stage of a bull market, where silver, as high beta gold, does do better. Then we will also likely see continued interest in the gold mining sector. It's in the early to mid portion of a precious metal bull market that the gold miners do best. It's when enthusiasm starts to really pick up that gold miners do worse than the gold price. And that's because they are encouraged to go off and speculate on the gold price themselves. They go and borrow a ton of money, they go to build new mines, and the uncertainty of all of that is certainly emblematic of real interest from the perspective of investors. But of course, it hits the bottom line, their cash flow generation goes to zero, and that's when, or at least that was certainly the case with the last bull market. That was when investors started to look elsewhere. That's when demand for ETFs increased, particularly those that are backed by physical gold. Now, when we look at what's going on right now, it's the exact opposite scenario. Gold miners are not investing in new mines. They are not going to banks and asking for lots of new money. In fact, the only thing that they are doing is trying to buy one another, but that does not increase the supply of the metal. It simply concentrates it in a smaller number of hands, and that is highly supportive of additional upside. These companies are now very much cash flow positive. With gold at $1,800, there are going to be miners out there that are making 100% margins, and that allows them to garner a great deal of free cash flow. It means that there's the potential for gold shares to increase their dividends. The only one of the gold shares that is in the S&P 500 is Newmont, and it has been, or at least it had the special dividend in 2019. But then we can see that the dividend itself was 14, all the way through from 2018 to 2020, and then it raised it to 25, and they have tied the size of their dividend to the gold price. So these types of investments where you get both leverage to the gold price because they have got a lower cost of production than the actual gold price, and then you get the potential for dividend growth on top of it, that is the kind of recipe that will attract investors into the sector. And it is likely to persist for as long as it takes enthusiasm about new mining projects to increase. But of course, it's not simply the precious metals that benefit from the lack of investment in new mine production. The London Metals Index of industrial resources has come right back to test the sequence of lower rally highs. Copper in particular has been resurgent, and it is consolidating now in the region of and below the $3 level. So this is a potential area where we can see some consolidation coming through. But if it can sustain a move above the 3 level, well, then we're back in a medium-term demand-dominated environment. In fact, it has already broken the downtrend. So as long as it is holding now the region of the trend mean, we can give the benefit of the doubt to the upside. Now, when we think about the mining sector generally, the FTSE 350 mining index has rebounded now from the region of the trend mean. It is coming back up towards this psychological 20,000 level. The Australian Resources Index, the ASX 300 resources, has pushed back above its trend mean as well. There is the clear potential that we are going to see additional upside in resources sectors just about anywhere. And I'm having difficulty remembering the Canadian Materials Index, but it has also looked very much like the gold miners because it is heavily weighted by gold miners. Now, one of the things that is obviously going to contribute to interest in commodities, and then also interest in cyclicals, is the outlook for global growth. Because if we look at the banking sector, we can see that it is that our outlook looks rather spotty. When we look at the resources sector, gold is certainly performing, and that is, and I think a big part of that is because of the devaluation of currencies. The oil price is obviously highly cyclical and highly levered to the global economy, and the price is continuing to hold this breakout from this range. And certainly if it can continue to hold the $37 level on Brent, then that will be supportive of the view that the lows are in fact in, and that there is scope for a reversion, or at least a rally back up towards the upper side of the range. The thing is, though, I do think that oil is going to look a lot more like natural gas 5 or 6 years from now. It's been exceptionally volatile. Since the evolution of shale gas and shale oil, then natural gas has been in a secular bear market. Now, that doesn't mean we can't have extreme trough to peak swings that are going to be in the order of 200%, but it remains a price structure that is going to remain under pressure. And I think that that is going to be simple, a very similar condition in oil, because there is just a huge quantity of oil that is available for production anywhere in the region of $50 to $60. And it means that that's going to represent the upper side of a long-term range. So when we think about investors looking for a return to performance by cyclicals, well, banks, it's a hard sell, and energy is a hard sell because of the secular bear market. But what we are seeing is that because of this extraordinarily low natural gas price, it is creating interest in portions of the energy sector. Hydrogen, for example, is certainly doing better. Then we also have the fact that the solar sector has been marching to its own drumbeat, particularly relative to the oil sector, and it pushed on to new recovery highs in here this week. So there is the clear potential here that what is likely in this occasion is that its renewables are going to be the primary cyclical play within the energy sector, and that the more traditional, heavily debt-burdened companies in the unconventional, I guess, sector in terms of hydraulic fracturing and horizontal drilling are going to remain under pressure. You also have the fact in the solar sector that that private equity firms have been able to engineer utility-like returns because of the leaseback business model, which is effectively they give you your solar cells for nothing, but then you pay them back for those solar cells indefinitely so that you minimize your electricity bill, but you do not alleviate it. And that has certainly helped to stoke interest in solar from big companies. One of the biggest power producers in the renewable sector is Brookfield. And that's another company that continues to do exceptionally well. And it has rebounded incredibly impressively over the course of the last couple of weeks. It's benefiting from extremely low interest rates and the utility interest rates that it can then pick up. So these kinds of companies are in fact replicating the kind of business model that banks had historically relied upon. They can borrow low and they can generate returns from utilities in a more reliable fashion than banks can now do with their loan books. So that's why they're starting to attract investor interest. So when we think about if technology has done spectacularly well and the kinds of technological solutions that are being provided continue to generate productivity growth, the growth of the cloud sector has been phenomenal. But the big question is how much of that growth has been pulled forward from the future. And I think that is one of the questions that was really asked by investors this week, and not least as we look at Netflix. Their guidance for what they're anticipating their third quarter subscription numbers to be came in well below Wall Street expectations. Personally, I cancelled my Netflix over the course of July because we just simply were not using it, and I just have not enjoyed any of the new shows, and I think my family have been very much the same. They are very much cookie cutter in terms of the quality. On the other hand, I did take out a subscription to HBO Max, and I think the whole family is enjoying it. But the reality is that from a cloud perspective, we haven't yet seen this kind of clear evidence that growth has been pulled forward from the future, whereas we definitely have it with Netflix. But the other point, of course, is that we've had this really quite impressive acceleration, and now we have got a peak of at least near-term significance. To walk back from this kind of downward dynamic in the space of 1 week and to completely countermand it, it would seem to be too much to ask. And the $400 area really does now need to represent support. When we think about Amazon, it also pulled back rather sharply in here this week. So it has now clearly pulled back below the 3,000 level. Now, One thing we know about Amazon is that it is prone to these accelerations and it is prone to sharp pullbacks. It will really need to sustain a move back below 2000 in order to question the overall bull market environment. But certainly, following the acceleration on what is one of the largest companies in the world, at least a period of consolidation appears to be likely. And that then does greatly enhance the scope that we're going to have a rotation. Then, of course, if we think about, well, what is it that could really help to drive not just a rotationary interest, but a true investment theme-based return to performance by industrial resources? Well, the chances are that it's going to be with regard to infrastructure. It's certainly going to be beneficial for Europe and the UK and for North America generally to invest more in infrastructure. And that is also potentially why we're seeing continued interest in renewables, because of the potential for a Green New Deal. The Democratic Party are talking about a $2 trillion infrastructure bill to really revolutionize the renewable sector. And it would appear that investors are riding on those coattails. So that is certainly something that can potentially now be more of an investment theme-led environment, as well as the fact that you've got low interest rates, which really do help to boost growth companies. When we think about what the long term represents, we know that there are these massive debts that are outstanding. This week I produced a number of charts for the price of gold adjusted for purchasing power parity in various currencies. And in US dollar terms, it has broken out of its range. It's coming back up towards the highs posted in 2011. And those are pretty close to the highs that were posted all the way back in the 1980s. When we look at these, not simply what it looks like in US dollar terms, but for example, when we look at the UK, then we get a similar condition, except that it is further along in terms of the process. So gold has already broken out in a purchasing power parity basis in the UK. When we look at it in the euro, well, then we get a very similar condition. And it has also broken on the upside. It's exactly the same when we look at it in Australian dollars. In fact, it has been rallying more in Australian dollars than it has in either the euro or the British pound. Now, the most important point here is that gold does best when it is appreciating in all currencies. And it is doing that today, not only on a nominal currency basis, but also on a purchasing power parity basis. And that is highly supportive of a new bull market environment. Now, some analysts are saying that the pullback from 2011 to 2015-16 was just a medium-term correction in an ongoing bull market. I'm rather leery of drawing that conclusion simply because of the massive bear market that took place in the commodities sector generally, and most particularly in the gold mining shares. But the entire process of rationalizing the gold mining shares has created the conditions for a significant new bull market. And the absence of performance from the gold mining sector was a missing condition for a lot of investors during the last bull market in gold. I really do suspect that they are going to perform much more admirably on this occasion, particularly in the first half of the bull market, than they did last time. But if gold is doing this well, it is because investors want to hedge their exposure to potential inflation. Now, when we think about velocity of money, it has been trending lower for years already. And it peaked in 1997. So this is something that is not updated all that often, and in fact, it was last updated on the 31st of December. But we can conclude that it is quite likely to collapse when it is updated for the first few months of this year. Now, that ensures that there's not going to be an inflationary outcome in the short term. Then when we think about, well, what is it that could create inflation? Well, there are a couple of, I think, important data points to pay attention to. The first is when you've got this massive contraction in the velocity of money, you can increase the size of the balance sheet indefinitely until the velocity of money starts to turn back upwards. So you have to start thinking about what is it that could turn that velocity of money back upwards. Well, strong economic growth would obviously be one of those. If the hiatus that we've had from the economy as a result of the virus-induced lockdowns, if we were to get a strong economic recovery, then velocity would pick back up, and the quantity of money that's been printed to deal with it would then become problematic and would put pressure on the Federal Reserve to withdraw some of it. Now, of course, that would have meaningful impacts for growth. There is the additional point of what do banks do with all the money that has been printed? What they have done over the course of the last 12 years has been to massively increase the reserves that they're holding with the Federal Reserve. One of the clearest potential outcomes that could create inflation is if banks were encouraged to lend once more. And that is also potentially possible. We're starting to see a growing movement in the USA in particular, looking at reparations for slavery. It has become a much more topical topic of discussion. We've already seen just today that one locality in North Carolina has voted to approve unanimously reparations, and rather than making payments, they're going to make much more investments into predominantly black neighborhoods. Well, then there is the potential for a new administration to offer tax breaks or to encourage banks to make the kinds of loans that would enable these kinds of reparations. The one thing that we know is that in order for inflation to really tick up, banks would have to start lending again, that we would need to see a lot more circulation of money and a lot more of economic activity. And this index of excess reserves would really need to come back below 1.5 trillion. We're perhaps not quite there yet. But the one thing we do know is that we have got interest rates that are nominally zero in a substantial number of countries. We still have about 14 trillion of bonds that are trading with negative yields, but 90% of all bonds, of all sovereign bonds, have got yields below 1%. Now, eventually, we're going to get to a situation where interest rates have had so much downward pressure that there will be a much greater percentage of bonds that have got close to negative interest rates. Now, that then creates the clear potential that the supply of money will explode. It also greatly enhances the potential for outright adoption of modern monetary theory, because there would be the assumption that we are in a deflationary spiral and that there is no moral hazard to massively increasing spending. So we know where inflation can potentially come from. We know where we are relatively well in the cycle because we're pretty close to the end in terms of bonds, but it probably will not end until we see more of the total value of bonds trading with negative yields. We also know that there is an inflationary hiccup somewhere out in the future. It could be geopolitical tensions. It could be much more aggressive efforts to decouple from China's manufacturing. These are all potential outcomes that could create an inflationary event. Now, when we think about what are the companies that do best in that kind of environment, well, it's got to be those that can raise their dividends faster than the rate of inflation. But we are already at a situation where a number of corporate balance sheets are heavily levered, and those are the kinds of companies that may have difficulty maintaining their capital ratios if the cost of capital rises substantially. So there are problems that are out on the horizon, but those are probably longer term problems. If we think about the next few months, we're likely to have a rotation out of high-flying tech into more cyclicals. If we think about the medium term, then we need to get past the US election. It is quite likely we're going to get a lot more spending, a lot more infrastructure-led development. That is quite likely to stimulate economic activity, and that we could move into a truly bubbly environment on the stock market. Then we get to a point where there are going to be issues with either paying down the debt or fomenting inflation by continuing to extend it. And those are longer term problems. And I think with that, I will leave you for today, and I'll wish all the best to all of you.